The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Kevin Fong. This week on the show, we've got, well, lots of nothing.
Loads of scientists have nothing built into the questions they ask, or they are asking questions directly about nothing.
New Scientist editor-in-chief Jeremy Webb joins me to discuss their collection of essays on the science of nothing and why omission is a powerful force in understanding our universe. Also, we'll be taking a look at this week's science news, including new research into how the permeability and molecular structure of our skull could help us understand and treat traumatic brain injury. Why exam results in secondary education apparently owe more to our genes than our teachers, and we'll be talking about an ancient reptile that was uniquely useless. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. But first up, we turn to this week's science news, and I'm joined by two brilliant science journalists. Nicola Davis is the commissioning editor of The Observer Tech Monthly, and Kerry Smith from Nature Magazine, presenter of the Nature podcast and Neuropod, and a writer for Nature News. Welcome to both of you.
Hi.
Hi there.
Okay, so our first story today is all about brains and brain injury. Kerry, what have you got for us?
Well, there's a new paper, actually, that's just come out in Nature, and it's about traumatic brain injury, which is a label for quite a diverse set of conditions. Whenever you get a bump on the head, or increasingly in, you know, NFL players will have this happen to them, they'll get a concussion during a match, or even military veterans returning from the battlefield might have something happen to their brain that's kind of a, you know, a concussive injury or a hit. And it's kind of unclear what happens to the brain in the immediate aftermath, and then, you know, months or years afterwards. So people have reported, you know, memory loss immediately after, but also, you know, longer term conditions, kind of, is this responsible for memory loss or even anxiety or anger later in life after the injury?
And all of this is happening inside a closed box, isn't it? So the problem is that people get these injuries and we can't see what's going on.
Exactly. So the researchers took two different approaches to look at that. So they had contacts with hospitals locally. They're based in the National Institutes of Health on the east coast of the States. And there were patients coming into those hospitals who had these kind of injuries. So they monitored those patients. They put radioactive tracers into their bloodstream so that when they were being scanned to see the nature of their injury, they could see where the blood was going and what was happening in their brains. And what they found in some cases, that even of mild traumatic brain injury, that there was blood kind of leaking through to the brain from the outside blood supply, which is not a very good thing.
So from outside the skull vault, outside the skull through, or from the layers covering the brain?
So there was basically just a breach. So there had been, normally the brain and the body are kept very separate, and it's very hard to get drugs, for example, from the blood into the brain. But in this case, there was damage and there was leakage and there were cells trying to kind of repair.
And when you say mild injury, Kerry, how mild an injury is causing this leakage across to the brain?
Well, it's not in all patients that it was happening. They reckon in about 10-12% of patients they could see this. But these are cases that they sometimes label mild TBI, which could just be, you know, you have a fall from a ladder, something like that. Your kid could get injured in the playground, and this kind of mild concussion might be a result of that. They're not saying this happens, I want to stress, in every case.
And so, you know, how do you go on to try and work out, you know, how important this is and what's happening to the brain?
Well, obviously, as you said, it's very hard to do that in humans. So they turned at this point to the experimenter's favourite model, the mouse. And in order to be able to look through this impenetrable skull, they actually, in the mice, they shaved bits of the skull off so that it was left as a paper thin, or actually the thickness of a human hair layer of skull left. And that enabled them to look through the skull with a camera and also to prod very gently the remaining bit of skull and then see what effect that very small injury might have.
And so with this literal window on the brain, what were they able to see?
They could see in greater detail and actually in greater sort of time resolution than people have been able to see before, exactly what was happening when the injury had just been caused and the direct result of that. And one of the most interesting things they saw was that some of the cells that are part of the brain's kind of immune army were being recruited to the surface very, very near the site of this injury and then spreading out and trying to kind of seal it off.
And does this give us any hope for a therapeutic intervention? Because in medicine, we're all about what we call a secondary injury. So there's nothing we can do at that point of injury, or that's what we're trained. There's nothing we can do about the initial injury. It's everything that happens afterwards that we protect against. So did they try any therapeutic interventions out on the mice?
They actually did. They tried them through this very thin layer of skull, which was, of course, is not very practical for the human case. But they also tried permeating the skull with molecules, basically, with little anti-inflammatory, a molecule called glutathione, which sort of eats up all these reactive oxygen species, which are thought to be very bad for the injury as it progresses. And they actually, I mean, to my complete surprise, talking to the researcher, they were able to diffuse these molecules through the mouse's skull, intact skull. And of course, the mouse skull is about like less than half a millimetre thick. So it's different to ours, which are kind of half a centimetre. So there's some way to go, of course, until they might be able to try this kind of treatment on the human case. But he doesn't rule that out.
And how soon after the injury were they diffusing these anti-inflammatory and free radical harvesting substances?
They were doing this, you know, essentially as soon as they could. So they had videotaped, if you like, the event happening. And then in a separate group of mice, they could transpose these little molecules through in the few hours after the injury.
Nicola, what do you think about all of this?
Well, it sounds absolutely fascinating. And it's obviously, you know, it's going to have some people quite concerned about, you know, whether a bump on the head they thought was quite innocuous is actually something that could be more sinister. What I'd be interested to know is how, you know, did they see that these injuries, you know, obviously they're more severe than they initially thought. Does the body actually manage to repair them over time, or are they actually injuries that do just persist?
So the body's repair mechanisms are these inflammatory kind of reduction. The reduction of the inflammation that takes place at the very beginning is a helpful thing to be doing, but then if you're not careful, it kind of goes a bit haywire, and that's when the longer term damage can start to be caused. So, and which is why they say an early intervention is going to be quite key for something like this, so that you can, you know, reduce the effects of those molecules and stop them having their longer term effects.
And does this therapy depend upon having to diffuse these substances through a thin skull wall, or could you, in theory, put a catheter in and deposit these chemicals directly onto the brain? I mean, we're talking about the possibility of first aid for traumatic brain injury. You know, it's something that we do not have. When it comes to first aid for brain injuries, we're pretty much in the dark ages at the moment. So does it sound like that's a possibility, that you might see a future in which you can get, you know, you don't have to go through a thin skull, you can just get into the skull and get onto the brain and deposit the stuff?
But in a way, why go through a traumatic operation like inserting something into the brain when you can diffuse these things through the skull? I mean, he suggests that maybe in the human case, because it's so much thicker, you might need to apply some pressure to it to get it to diffuse a bit more easily. And it will take, you know, minutes, maybe hours to complete that process. But I think I'd rather that, I don't know about you, than something actually drilling into my skull, diffusing these molecules.
Yeah, I've done that once or twice. You don't want me doing it, certainly. Okay, all right. Now from Brain Knox to Brain Box. Nicola, you've got a story that reads like it was written by Boris Johnson himself. Apparently our genes are what matters when it comes to educational achievement. Tell us more about that, Nicola.
So this is talking about a science story that came out this last week, which talked about the impact of genetics on your learning abilities, or on basically on your exam results, to be quite specific. And a piece of research has come out which shows, or claims to show, that genetics accounts on average for 58% of the differences in exam results that children achieved. Which is, I'm not sure whether, you know, you'd find that shocking or not surprising, but it's certainly an interesting statistic nonetheless. So these studies were carried out by looking at identical twins and fraternal twins. So these are twins of the same sex and twins of different sexes, if to put it extremely simply. So it's a very interesting study, and it has some interesting points that came out. So as I said, 58% of the differences on average were due, they claim, to genetics. But this isn't true across all subjects. So the sciences, they found, were more heritable than the humanities subjects. So you have a 58% influence from genetics, apparently, on your exam results for sciences, but only a 42% influence on humanities subjects.
And is this, when you say influence, are you talking just about exam results? And if you're talking about exam results, which exams?
Yes, so this was done by looking at GCSE results. So the data was collected from those results taken by twins. And the point here is, of course, that identical twins have the same genetics. They have the same genome. So you can sort of take the genetic impact out when you're looking at other factors, environmental factors and such like. So it gives you a nice way of comparing genetics against environmental factors.
So are you convinced? The opening gamut sounds quite compelling, doesn't it? You've got people who share pretty much the same set of genes, and you're seeing comparative performance amongst the two of them. So it sounds pretty convincing at the outset. Why aren't you? You don't sound convinced.
Well, we know that your genes influence a huge amount about who you are and how you behave and all sorts. I mean, genetics is what makes us in many ways who we are. We all know that. But there are aspects of this that I would like to know more about. I find it a bit unexpected that your educational achievement or your heritability of educational achievement differs between subjects. That seems a bit strange to me. At least that's certainly one point that'd be different.
That there should be more of an influence over mathematical and science subjects than there is over humanities. You're surprised.
That does seem strange. And also, I think there's no mention here about sort of epigenetics. So, you've got nature and nurture, you've got, what genetics you're born with, and you've got your environment and how you interact with that. But then we also know that epigenetics is a huge field, and that's sort of how the environment affects your genes and changes to your DNA. So, that's also could be something which would be interesting to look at and which doesn't appear to be mentioned at the moment.
So, Nicola, you don't seem to be convinced that the big cornflakes in Boris Johnson's packet are genetically determined particularly.
Well, I just think that education and learning and our behaviours are extremely complex and intricate areas to be looking at, and I always find sort of blanket statistics a little bit too simplistic sometimes.
Kerry, what do you think of all this? Convinced? Not convinced?
This stuff is a minefield. The genetics of intelligence, the genetics of educational achievement, not only are they really hard studies to do, but they've got really big implications. The way you phrased it just then, are these things genetically determined? I mean, that's a kind of a dangerous word to use, because this study isn't really telling us that, okay, you're stuck with your genes and that's as well as you're going to do at school and that's the end of it and you might as well go home if your genes are not, written in the right way. There's a large environmental component here too. They say over 30%, over 30% of your performance is determined by your environment. So it's not all about the genetics. I mean, these are things that the researcher would probably caution us against too.
Kerry, this work isn't just the first of its kind. There's other work this is building on. Tell me about that.
There's actually a really long history of quite controversial work into the genetics and the heritability of intelligence, and in this case, educational achievement. So this same group, led by Robert Plomin, who's based here in London, they've done similar studies before about the heritability of educational achievement at younger levels, and found that indeed quite similar statistics, sort of 60-odd percent, is heritable of that kind of pattern, even at the lower ranges. And so here they're redoing that same study with a giant data set for GCSE results particularly. And Robert Plomin's also been involved in work to really kind of get down to the nitty-gritty of what genes we're actually talking about here when we talk about intelligence. So he's been involved before in trying to run projects where he gets hold of loads of geniuses and sequences all of their genomes, which is something they didn't do here. They're just looking to see, are these people twins, therefore do they share all their genome, or are they not? So that's kind of a different type of study, but that, and controversial in its own way, but that could give us some insight into which actual genes are responsible for things like intelligence.
I think one thing which is also important to take away from this is that it's not going to change the education system overnight. How useful is this information? How can we actually implement this in any way? How can we tailor education? Is this a helpful way for us to tailor education? These are all questions which are going to be being asked, I would imagine, over the coming weeks and months and no doubt years.
But I mean, is there any sense in which any of this work could or should alter your system of education?
I think that one can never discount the effect that a good teacher will have on students, and that a motivational environment will have on students, and that peer effects will have on students. These are all big things that we know affect how people behave at school and how they view learning and education in general. And I think there's a danger of sort of brushing those to one side and honing in on genetics. I mean, obviously genetics is something that we should be looking at, and you know, there might be useful and meaningful things that we can take from this study and apply to our education system. But good teaching and, you know, supportive education environment at home and all these things we know are also really important. So it would be very sad if we stopped focusing on those and threw everything at doing things with genetics.
And finally, Kerry, I always thought pandas were evolution's most ridiculous animal, but you've found something even more useless than them.
I've tried. This is a really charming little story about pterosaurs, who may indeed have been worse than pandas at living, and that might have been why they're now extinct. This was a new paper, paleo paper, by one of your bloggers, actually, Dave Hone. He's written a blog about it, and he's also one of the researchers who's done this study. And they were looking at how pterosaurs floated, or whether indeed they were very good at this. They know from previous research that pterosaurs and their ilk, which are kind of flying reptiles, obviously extinct now, live near the sea, may have, you know, interacted with the ocean, ate fish. This sort of thing definitely happened in their lives. So they wanted to see whether they were going to be floating like Canada geese in flocks on the water, or just sort of skimming the water to catch fish and go away again. So they built a computer model of a pterosaur to try and understand that.
And my understanding of this family of dinosaurs is that there's a question about how good they are at flying in the first place. So this is an animal that lives by the sea, eats fish, and is airborne, but isn't good at flying and isn't good at floating.
In the floating case, they built this model to understand exactly how bad they were at floating. So they looked at the bone density of these creatures and the shape of the skeleton. And there's a little computer model. I can see it here on the screen. And for listeners, it's not going to be worth me demonstrating this, but they basically floated with their bodies half submerged and their faces half submerged as well in the water, which doesn't seem to be a particularly useful place to be. Even their nostrils might have been submerged.
So this was based on looking at their bones. I mean, is there a chance that they were extremely fatty birds that kind of bobbed up on the surface due to some highly calorific
fish oils.
There sounds like there is a possibility. There is also a possibility that the reason they're not around anymore is because their default state was nearly drowning.
and the last line of the paper, actually, of the abstract says, you know, there are loads of these juvenile pterosaur fossils found, many more than you'd expect from how many terrestrial dinosaur fossils we find, and maybe it's because they just were really hapless at swimming.
The question is, were they all found at the bottom of the ocean? Did they literally just sink like a stone?
It's possible. Imagine.
Oh, it sounds cool to make fun of an extinct species, but really, it's got it coming. Thank you very much, Kerry. Thank you very much, Nicola. Well, a big thank you to Kerry Smith from Nature and our own Nicola Davis. For this story and all the stories we discussed, you'll find links on our blog at theguardian.com/scienceweekly. It's that time of year when we peruse the bookshops and think about what to buy the science buffs in our lives. And if your mind goes blank and you see a book called Nothing, I suggest you grab it. This book is a compendium of essays looking at a broad range of scientific research into, you guessed it, nothing. To tell me more, I'm joined now by Jeremy Webb, editor-in-chief of New Scientist, the publishers behind this book. Jeremy, hi. Welcome to Science Weekly. We're going to talk about nothing for a little while. Why write a book about nothing?
There's just a delightful absurdity about a book filled with nothing. I mean, that was the first thing. I think that's, you know, the first attraction. And then you think, well, okay, well, it's a great idea, but what can go in it? And what we started doing was asking, well, okay, from a multidisciplinary perspective, let's look at physics, let's look at maths, let's look at biology. You know, what can go in it? And what we found is that loads of scientists have nothing built into the questions they ask, or they are asking questions directly about nothing. And there's this massive amount of work. And you can sort of look through the whole of science through the lens of nothing. That's what we've done.
And so this book is a collection of previously published essays from New Scientist magazine, is that correct?
Yep, most of them are.
And so amongst them, when you were pulling them together, what were your favourites? What was your favourite bit of nothing from this collection?
So I think my favourite bit of nothing here is why are there some animals that appear to do nothing? And it's one of these great questions where a scientist has said, you know, look at that animal. You know, it's doing nothing. Why? You know, real fundamental curiosity-driven research. And what they found is sometimes astonishing. So you take a snake. You know, snakes lie around in the sun all day long, and they don't do much for a long time, especially after they've eaten. And you think, well, you know, why? You know, what isn't it off finding another meal? And it turns out that they eat so infrequently that they allow their heart and their digestive tract to actually shrink when they're not eating. So once they've eaten, they have to rebuild those organs. And then they have to use a massive amount of energy to pass their meal through their gut. And their metabolic rate has to increase by something like 40-fold in a very short period of time. And the only other animal we know that can do that is a racehorse at full gallop. So you see the snake sunbathing and you think, lazy thing. But in fact, it is going like a train and it can't do anything else because it's using all its energy to digest its last meal.
And that's right. I mean, I remember that very evocative description you had of these animals really on the edge of a metabolic precipice, aren't they, really? That if they did any more, it would be catastrophic.
That's right. So the other classic animal that we think of as lazy is the sloth. And the thing about sloths is that They live in rainforests where the monkeys get all the good stuff. So the monkeys take the fruit, which is high in nutrients, high in protein. And the sloth are left with very, very indigestible leaves, often poisonous. So they have to neutralize the poison. They have to produce their own chemicals to neutralize the poison. And then they have to have other enzymes which will extract any goodness from those leaves. And sloths are often living on the edge of starvation. But you don't think that is why they're moving slowly. You think they're lazy, but they haven't got any option. And, you know, what a great answer to a simple question.
Next time anyone accuses me of being a couch potato, I'll just say, look, I'm just surviving here. So let's move on to the cosmic nothing. You know, that's the thing that we think about when we talk about nothing. And I read that essay about, you know, where the universe came from, when did it start, when did time start? And, you know, I know the sort of underlying mathematical truth of it, but still I found my head bending around saying, really, it's just a bit of a fudge, it's a bit of a cop-out to say that there is no beginning, that there was no beginning to all of this, that you know, it's all an indeterminate point in time and nothing may have existed before, but that doesn't matter. What? Just make me feel that isn't just a massive scientific cop-out.
Well, you know, what's the alternative? God made the universe? Perhaps we shouldn't go there. And let me just start off by saying we're talking metaphysics here. You know, it is very, very difficult and speculative to go back and look to the very beginning of time. But the argument goes like this. It wasn't just matter that appeared in the Big Bang. It was also space and time. And if you think that time began at the Big Bang, asking the question, what came before the Big Bang, is nonsense. Because as Stephen Hawking says, it's like asking what's north of the North Pole. And it just doesn't make any sense. Okay, now why is that important? It's important because we have inside us an inbuilt understanding that an effect always follows a cause. And so we think that if the universe started at that point, there must have been something that started it. But in fact, that's not the case. So at that point, you know, the universe was this very, very hot, dense object, smaller than a pea, which is ruled by quantum theory. Now, in quantum theory, you don't need a cause. So the argument goes, so let me give you an example first. If you take a bunch of uranium atoms, uranium is radioactive, and at some point, all of those nuclei in those atoms will emit radioactivity and they will decay. Now, if you try to decide which one will go first, you will fail. If after they've started to decay, you say, why did that one go but that one there didn't emit radioactivity, you will fail to find the answer. And you will fail because randomness is actually built into the fibre of reality at the smallest level, at the quantum level. It's not that our knowledge isn't deep enough, it's that randomness is built into the fabric of reality. And because of that, it is conceivable, and I have to say it's conceivable, that the universe began from a random fluctuation. And that's really as far as you can say.
And I mean, I'm kind of happy to deal with that, I guess, that this, all of this, everything around us, the past 7 billion years, arises out of this quantum fluctuation sometime in the past. But then you get onto the main assault on the whole thing, which is, well, where do the laws that govern that come from in the first place? And so this was the thing in reading that particular essay, was I kept flick-flacking in and out of, oh, I can accept it, no, I can't, I can, I can't.
Well, so that's a really great point to raise, and that is mathematics and the natural laws that created our universe, are they somehow independent of the reality in which we're in? And that is, you know, we're in deep philosophical territory here now, and I don't have the answer to that, and neither did Paul Davis, the academic who wrote that particular feature.
Well, it's a mind-bending essay, and from that to subjects which was supposed to be as dull as ditch water, or as interesting as watching grass grow or paint dry. You often send your journalists out to do those things.
Well, you know, you've got to ask unusual questions and get people, you know, interested in science. We were talking about nothing, and you know what's more interesting than nothing, and somebody said watching grass grow. You know, that's how you do it. So we sent the features editor out to go and ask.
So this was a specially commissioned essay for the book, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't for the book. It was for one of the special issues that we did, from which I took a lot of these articles.
Okay, and as I recall, your features editor found watching grass grow and studying ditch water much more interesting than one would expect.
Well, that's right. And the point is that as soon as you start asking questions, new questions arise. And you look at ditch water and you find out there's an entire ecosystem in there. You look at grass and you find out that grass isn't grass as we think it is. It isn't quite as dull. You can get fast-growing, slow-growing. You can even hear grass grow. You know, and when you start looking at these things in detail, you know, the world is a wonderful place.
So from that to thinking about nothing, or trying to think about nothing, and what you can discover about the brain when the brain isn't doing anything else. Tell me about that, because that was really interesting. And this is quite in vogue at the moment, this so-called default mode network of the brain.
So this goes back to an experiment that was done donkeys ages ago, 1953. Louis Sokolov, American scientist, stuck a medical student on a gurney, which I'm sure still goes on in medical schools today. And he measured the oxygen and carbon dioxide content of his blood, and he measured his brain waves while he did some really difficult mathematics. And then he asked the student to relax and try to think about nothing. And you might expect that the brain would slow down, and it didn't. And that raised a really fundamental question. And that is, what is the brain doing when you think you're resting it? And it wasn't until the late 1980s, as brain scanning became common, that some scientists started looking at, okay, well, let's study what's going on in the brain when people rest. And what they found was that there is an area right down the centre of the brain from the nose backwards, and there are a bunch of regions around that axis which light up as soon as you close your eyes and try to think about nothing. And that's called the default network now. The initial idea was, well, okay, it involved the medial prefrontal cortex, it involved the hippocampus. The first area is involved in looking at the world from an egocentric situation. We know that the hippocampus is involved in storing autobiographical memory. So the thought was, okay, well, perhaps this is daydreaming. Perhaps that's what we're looking at. And that was the initial position up until, I would say, about 2 or 3 years ago. But 2 or 3 years ago, people have now found the default network lighting up when people are in sleep, in the early stages of sleep, and when they're heavily sedated. So it's clearly nothing to do with daydreaming. So what people think now is that potentially this is this default network is storing your memories and tagging them with what they mean to you. So was it a happy memory? Was it an emotionally disturbing memory? Was it threatening? That sort of thing. And that's where we are with the default network now. But again, if somebody hadn't asked the question, what does the brain do when we think about nothing, we wouldn't have known about the default network at all.
Jeremy, the last question I guess I have to ask is the question we always ask about all sciences: what does the future hold for this? So what does nothing have to offer us in the future?
Well, I'll tell you that I edited this book earlier in the year, and since then there have been two or three other articles which I could have included. So, you know, there might be a second Nothing book. I can see you'll be really delighted to see that. But I think that there are areas where we are going to find out more about nothing. I think in terms of quantum theory, we're going to find out more about nothing. There is still a big question over consciousness. And one of the ways to look for consciousness is to look for the absence of consciousness and check what's happening in the brain when, and that's because you feel nothing in those sort of circumstances. Absolute zero, we're getting closer and closer to absolute zero in terms of temperature, and we've got this strange world to look at down there. Higher and higher vacuums. We are really good now at making vacuums, and we've got this whole host of different methods for making higher and higher vacuums. The beam line at CERN, for example, where the particles go round and round, has to be a very high vacuum. So there are a whole range of questions still to be asked with nothing on the end of it.
Well, brilliant. Well, it's a fantastic book. I look forward to the sequel, which I think you should already call Absolutely Nothing. And I'll take my royalties for that. Thank you very much. And so, Jeremy, thank you for talking to us today. Fantastic.
Great to be.
Nothing is now out in paperback and available in all good on and offline bookshops. That's all we have for you this week. Remember, for breaking science news in text, audio and video form, just go to theguardian.com/science. But from me, Kevin Fong, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.